when he was a young man, he never thought he'd see people stand in line to see the boy king.
King Tut.
How'd you get so funky?
Funky Tut.
Did you do the monkey?
Born in Arizona.
A little King Tut to get us started on this Monday morning. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Steve Martin did that song on Saturday Night Live in April of 1978. That's from an episode that many people, including our guest today, say it's the single best episode in the 50-year history of Saturday Night Live. But who has seen every episode? Well, our first guest has seen all 988 of them. Joined today by Christian Schneider. He's the co-host of the podcast, Wasn't That Special? 50 Years of Saturday Night Live. Spent time as a columnist at USA Today and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His pieces have appeared in the New York Times, National Review, among others. And he writes the newsletter Anti-Knowledge on Substack. So as we move along today, talk about Saturday Night Live. I hope you'll join in. Did you watch the show, or have you watched the show? Are you a fan favorite? What are some of your favorite cast members, maybe? Do you have favorite moments from the show? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can go ahead and email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Christian Schneider, welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
988 episodes.
Oh, boy.
That's a major undertaking. How did this whole thing start?
Well, it's part of it's a testament to just how long SNL has been around. It's been around for 50 years, and how relevant it still is. For the people at home, Larry was laughing uproariously at the King Tut piece, which shows you that it's still very relevant. But you know, both me and my co-host Scott Bertram, he's a radio guy, so he's the real talent. I'm just kind of along for the ride. But we decided, you know, we're both big fans of the show. There really are two SNLs. There's the SNL as it originally ran, and then there's the SNL as we remember it.
Yeah.
And those can often be two very different things. So we decided to go back and said, let's watch every one of these, and let's codify each episode. We grade every sketch on every show, and then we come to a decision on, you know, what grades out as the best sketches, the best episodes, the best seasons. Let's do this almost kind of in a scholarly fashion and see what we can come up with. And it took 2 years. We watched almost 1,000 episodes. One of these days, I'm going to relearn the names of my children. But it was a lot of fun. And it's, you know, part of it is, you know, SNL is really an almanac of America over the past 50 years.
Yeah.
Just because of the way they put together the show, it's, you know, it's things that happened during the week. So when you go back and you watch these episodes, you think, oh, they're joking about this. I completely forgot that had happened. Or, you know, sometimes there's something happening and they're totally prescient in what they predict is going to happen. And we can look back at that in retrospect. And it's really amazing sometimes the types of things you see. So really what we wanted to do, and a benefit to us, was to see it and kind of remember a lot of the things that were huge news at the time that we've now completely forgotten.
Forgotten about. Well, that Steve Martin episode, the first one, and you say it was the best episode in the history of Saturday Night Live.
So I wanted to be a contrarian and say that it wasn't, because there's a famous book, a Hill Weingrad book. It's called Saturday Night, and it's a classic book about the first 5 years of the show. And in that book, they say everybody kind of knows that this is the best episode ever of SNL. And I like to be contrarian. I thought, okay, well, let's see. Let's watch all of the episodes and then we'll see. And as it turns out, it really is the best. I didn't want it to be, but it really is, because it's got Steve Martin, who, of course, a classic host. People, to the point where people think he was actually a cast member when, of course, he wasn't.
Yeah.
In those first 5 years, I think he only hosted maybe 8 times.
But he was good every time.
but he was great every time. And so, out of, let's see, 5 years, over 100 episodes, he was only there 8 times. But he was so good while he was there, people still kind of associate him with the classic first 5 years of the show. But, so when we were done with the whole 50-year process, we were able to go back and look at all of our grades and, in our Excel spreadsheet and figure out. And this is the one that graded out the best. It had King Tut. It had the Festrunk brothers, who people don't know their names, but they're the wild and crazy guys. There's a piece where he dances with Gilda Radner, which, of course, would become... Yeah. Really touching later when we find out, what happened to Gilda Radner a few years later. But it really is. He's obviously one of the best, greatest hosts, and it all came together. I think that's in the third season.
Yeah. Anne in Marshfield has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Anne.
Hello. I have not always watched Saturday Night Live, but, our family still references the motivational speaker played by Chris Farley, and that when we're in a bad spot, we're going to live in a van down by the river. We still use that phrase.
Remember when you were in the Beatles? And remember when you were in the Beatles? And you did that album, Abbey Road, and at the very end of the song, song goes, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. You remember that?
Yes.
Is that true?
That was an interview supposedly with Paul McCartney that Chris Farley was doing.
Yeah, Chris Farley, obviously huge here in Wisconsin, a Wisconsin legend, and there have been a few Wisconsin connections with the show in the past. Ann Risley, who joined the sixth season, which was the season after the initial cast left, she lasted about 12 episodes before they decided this isn't working, and they had to recast basically the whole thing. Joan Cusack, who spent time in Madison, was on the show as well. And, a lot of Wisconsin connections. And Chris Farley, of course, who doesn't love Chris Farley?
I wonder what was his impact in your mind on Saturday Night Live?
So, we ended up doing our best cast members of all time list. And you'll see Chris Farley oftentimes in the top 10. Everybody loves Chris Farley, obviously. But this gets down to kind of like what we remember versus like what was actually on the screen during the show. And he was very good. He had some of the biggest highlights of the show. He had Matt Foley, who Anne just referenced. He had the Paul McCartney thing. He had the Chippendale sketch where he's going to be an erotic dancer and competing with Patrick Swayze, another classic sketch that was actually fairly controversial at the time. A lot of Farley's friends thought it was exploitative of his weight and things like that, and that it may have caused him body issues and all that stuff. Chris Rock especially thinks that sketch itself might have had something to do with what eventually happened to Farley. But so he was obviously great. But, he ended up getting fired from the show after season 20 because it was just kind of, it wasn't always outstanding. He kind of had one move a lot of times, like a closer in baseball, if they didn't know how to end a sketch, they would just bring Farley in to fall down or scream or do something like that. So and then he wasn't always available because of, you know, sadly, because of his substance abuse problems. Mm. He would miss big parts of seasons, and then he would come back and not be totally with it. One time when he came back from rehab, the very next show they did a sketch making fun of like a rehab guy, the guy that always relapses. And it's just really hard to watch. He was a scene stealer for sure. I think that probably got on the nerves of a lot of his cast members. But again, everybody loves Chris Farley. He was like the everyman that everybody could relate to. He had real guy problems, and one of the best for sure.
Scott in Iron River, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Scott.
Yes, hi. This is a great show. What you're talking about is kind of the direction I wanted to go, but you know, whenever I bring up Saturday Night Live, people often refer to the very original glory years, which were great, but I thought the years you're kind of talking about right now were the absolute best. And kind of prior to Farley, you know, with Dana Carvey and Mark Myers and Phil Hartman, I thought those were the absolute best years. And then it kind of goes in and out of what you were just talking about, where it's just kind of overly zany, but not very funny at times. And so I just wondered if you could comment on that. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, Scott.
Yeah, part of the reason that we wanted to do this was because there is so much love for the first five seasons. And obviously, they do get a lot of credit because this is something that American TV hadn't seen before.
And they were really good.
and they were really, really good. And you would think that watching all 50 seasons would make us say, well, obviously, have a new appreciation for those 5 years and say, obviously, those years are better than all the others. But I think it's done the exact opposite. I think, you know, those first 5 years were good, but there were a lot of clunkers. There were a lot of things that didn't work. It took almost the first full season for them to really figure out what the show was about and how it worked. I mean, you had bits in there with the Muppets. You had, little movies that didn't work. And so it took them a while for them to get it going. And by, you know, season 15, 30, et cetera, they really kind of had a formula. So if anything, the later years, kind of the last 20 years, has given me an appreciation for those years, because when you stack those seasons up versus the first five, they're actually somewhat comparable. And, Lorne Michaels' thing is always, you know, the seasons where you were in high school are always going to be your favorite seasons, right?
And, why?
So we wanted to test that, and it turns out that the seasons when I was in high school are actually the best based on our rankings. And those were the seasons where the caller just mentioned Phil Hartman, Dana Carvey, John Lovitz, that whole cast. Mike Myers came in at the very end. He was kind of the linchpin between that cast and the Chris Farley, Adam Sandler, David Spade, and that cast moving forward. So, based on our rankings, those seasons, like the late 80s and maybe just touching on the early 90s, were probably the best.
Scott, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, as we talk about Saturday Night Live with Christian Snyder. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about Saturday Night Live with Christian Snyder. He's co-host of the podcast. You ought to take a listen there. Wasn't That Special? 50 years of Saturday Night Live, and he's the author of the book 1916, the blog, and writes newsletters, Anti-Knowledge, on Substack. So it's great to have him with us. Questions or comments, or maybe a remembrance that you want to share about Saturday Night Live, I hope you'll join in at 800 642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Just a kind of a procedural question here. All the episodes are available for streaming, but in most cases, I think they've been edited, usually because of music rights. How did you get the complete episodes?
Yeah, so if you go on to Peacock, you can watch the first five seasons unedited, and then maybe like the last 9 or 10 seasons are also unedited. But those ones in the middle, they are edited because they couldn't afford the music rights. If any sketch has music in it, they would have to pull it. And I'm sure there are probably some sketches that they've pulled from Peacock just because they didn't age particularly well, which is something that we talk about a lot on the podcast, which every episode we talk about the 3 or 4 sketches that probably wouldn't be able to run in the year 2025, which are, those are always really interesting. So, but yeah, so you can watch most of them on Peacock. We were able to just through kind of the internet and finding people who have you know, old VCR tapes sitting around that were able to get them to us. But we scrounged around and we were able to find all the unedited versions that we were able to watch. And so that was a huge bit, because there's some of the, you know, some classic sketches that have music in them that that you wouldn't be able to see on Peacock. So
I'm wondering, you know, we watched it, if you're watching it on TV, it's once a week. And you guys were probably listening to several in a row, or you were watching them in a different kind of format. Do you think that had any impact on how you judge the shows?
I think that is something that we discussed, and it's true, because a lot of the bits that they do, you know, you in the old days, you would watch it on a Saturday night. You'd go and you'd talk to your friends on Monday about what you had seen at work. And then it's another week, or it could be another 3 weeks before there's another show. And then you kind of see the same bit, but you had already forgotten about it. And so it's, you know, for recurring characters like Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry do the cheerleaders. You know, when you sit and you watch the shows back to back to back to back, as we do today, when you binge watch, after about the third time, you're like, oh, gosh, this again? And so I'm sure the experience at the time would have been very different, because you would have had a lot more time in between to kind of absorb all of this. But yeah, recurring characters are something that we talk about a lot. And it really kind of is the way that people judge the show looking back. Anytime you see a list of best cast members or best seasons, you'll see a list of like, well, you know, this one had this recurring character. This one had, you know, John Lovitz's, serial liar guy, or this one had, you know, Matt Foley, or this one had this, because recurring characters are so burned into people's minds.
Yeah.
And that's what they remember. And so that's basically what they judge certain seasons on. And there are a lot of great sketches that people just don't remember because they only ran once.
So you guys, you and your co-host, did a full ranking of the cast members from worst to best, and you had a little disagreement about who was the best.
We did. I put Eddie Murphy as the number one cast member of all time, just because he was such an incredible talent that basically carried the show on his back after the original five left. So season 6 comes in, and Eddie Murphy's really kind of an afterthought. They find this 19-year-old kid on the street, and they put him in, and you know, he does a Weekend Update bit. He's kind of in the background in a couple of things. And then they realize that this new cast that's, I mean, it would have been impossible for them to succeed just because of the expectations by the first 5 years and that incredible cast, the Gilda Radners, the Bill Murrays, Chevy Chase, you know, Dan Aykroyd, you know all the names. So the show was just about to be canceled. I mean, they almost had it done. And then in season 7, they realize, oh my gosh, we have this guy, Eddie Murphy, who is, you know, he's a comet. He can do anything. He's just so naturally funny and can do anything. And so he starts doing Buckwheat. He starts doing, all of his other characters. And, Mr. Robinson. Mr. Robinson was really kind of his first breakout on the show. And, that turned into a great bit. So for me, Eddie Murphy basically saved the show when it needed it the most. And he's just an incredible talent, unlike anybody on the show. And there hasn't been really anybody to me that has, they've been trying to replace him for 40 years, 45 years.
We've got a little clip of him as Buckwheat. Oh, man.
Again, probably the type of thing that you couldn't do today. And when he actually... So he was sore about some jokes that David Spade made about him on one of the shows. And so he cut ties with SNL completely, refused to be on any of the any shows, wouldn't come back for the anniversary shows. But then I think in season 45 or 46, he finally came back and hosted. And one of the things... One of the common threads during that show was how many of the characters he played in the 80s that he could not possibly do today. Like Velvet Jones. I won't talk about it here, but you can look it up. And Buckwheat and other things. And it was really kind of about like how the show has changed as much as that.
I kind of agree with you. I think your partner thought Will Ferrell.
So I had Will Ferrell at number two, which surprised me. Going into this, I knew Will Ferrell was a great SNL cast member, but I did not expect him to carry the show in a way that he did, from 1995 on. As I mentioned, during those last 2 years of Chris Farley and Adam Sandler, seasons 19 and 20, the show was really juvenile. There was a really bad magazine article that came out about the show, and it was really on its last legs. And so they fire Sandler and Farley, and then they bring in this unknown comic from the Groundlings in Los Angeles, and his name is Will Ferrell. And he goes on and just basically carries the show for the next 7 years to some really, really good seasons. And again, without Will Ferrell, I think there probably wouldn't be any SNL today, just because he was so much better than everybody else on the show at the time. It was basically just the Will Ferrell show for about 7 years. And he was incredible.
We have a clip of him doing the cowbell
yes,
sketch.
Yes, of course.
Then once more cowbell, we should probably give him more cowbell.
Say, baby.
And Bobby, you are right. I am being selfish. But the last time I checked, we don't have a whole lot of songs that feature the cowbell.
I gotta have more cowbell, baby.
But I'd be doing myself a disservice and every member of this band if I didn't perform the hell out of this.
Oh, man. So, as you think about it, what makes a great cast member? Is it the impressions, the characters, something else?
Yeah, I mean, there's some combination of all those things. Like, my co-host Scott is a big Phil Hartman guy. Mm-hmm. And it seems like in those years, like the late 80s, you kind of had to be either, it was like the Rolling Stones or the Beatles, you kind of had to be a Phil Hartman guy or a Dana Carvey guy. And I'm more of a Dana Carvey guy just because he could do voices. I mean, he could sing, he could do really weird type of humor. He just really had it all. Whereas for me, Phil Hartman is still great. I still had him in my top 10. But most of the characters that he's doing are basically Phil Hartman. like some version of himself. And then of course you had female cast members who could sing, they could dance, they could They could do really weird characters. They could do accents. The best cast members really can kind of do it all.
You mentioned Phil Hartman, and we got a call from Kelly, who couldn't stay with us, but she said that after Phil Hartman died, his children were relocated to stay with family in Eau Claire. His wife was from Eau Claire, so kind of another connection to Wisconsin.
Yeah, Phil Hartman, I mean, he was amazing, and it is so tragic. I mean, and that's kind of the thing that hangs over SNL. Like, there's so many tragic endings to so many of these people that we grew to revere over the years.
Arlene, we called and couldn't stay with us, wanted you to know about or to comment on Gilda Radner and her place in the show's history. I loved her on the show.
She's fantastic. I think I had her as maybe my fourth or fifth greatest of all time. She basically set the template for every female cast member that would go on for years and years. My line about Gilda Radner is not everything she was in was great, but she was great in everything she was in. I mean, whether it was a good sketch or a bad sketch, she gave it her all. She wasn't afraid to look foolish or look silly. There have been some cast members who you can kind of tell they want to do the sketches, but they don't really want to make a fool of themselves on TV. They want to maintain some sort of dignity. But not Gilda. She would just throw her around the room. She played like a punk rocker named Candy Slice. I forget the name of the character, but the girl in her bedroom where she's jumping on her bed and bouncing off the walls. And then, of course, you had Rosanna Dana, who's a total fresh new thing happening on Weekend Update. And she's just outstanding. And so she walked Amy Poehler and Kristen Wiig and all the others that came after her could run. And she's just outstanding.
Michael in Middleton wants you to comment on the short films of Albert Brooks from the first season.
Yeah, this was a main point of contention between me and my co-host. I didn't like them all that much. And when you do the reading on those seasons, you know, Albert Brooks signed up to do, you know, a short film. I don't know if it was per episode, but every couple of episodes. And Albert Brooks, for good reason, probably has a pretty outsized ego and demanded that his stuff get on there unedited the way that he wanted it. And I think some of it was probably too long. Like, there's one of his allegedly short films that goes on for 12, 13 minutes. And you can't really do that on SNL. Most sketches are 3-4 minutes. But he kind of commandeered the show. And at some point, they just figured this isn't working out. And fortunately, he went on to go make other great movies. But my co-host, Scott Bertram, loved them for the most part. And so we had some disagreements.
Ruth in Milton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ruth.
Oh, hi. The ones who played Bob Dole and Newt Gingrich on the president's airplane, they're sitting together and trying to get the attention of the president, who would have been Clinton.
And there's so political. Thanks for calling in, Ruth. It brings to mind political sketches. And there were different ones. She mentioned Clinton. And we do have one. We do have one sketch, Phil Hartman as Bill Clinton at a McDonald's.
Do you favor the decision to send military forces to Somalia?
That's a good question. Yes, I do. Let me tell you why. See, right now, we're sending food to Somalia. But it's not getting to the people who need it because it's being intercepted by warlords. It's not just us. It's other countries, too. Like your McNugget is released from Great Britain to Somalia, intercepted by warlords.
Oh, my gosh. Well, the politicals, you know, everybody, I mean, there was no reason not to skewer anybody.
Mm-hmm.
On this, what are some of the political figures or scandals that Saturday Night Live handled particularly memorably? I think the Bill Clinton one was probably a good one.
That sketch, I think, might be either the first or second greatest political sketch in the history of the show, and one of the greatest satires in probably American political history. Because in that sketch right there, you have Phil Hartman doing Bill Clinton. And the sketch isn't even, it's not even 4 minutes long. But in that time, they completely nailed Bill Clinton. And this is before Clinton even takes office. So he's not even in office yet. He's still running. But it's a perfect distillation of Bill Clinton's, of how his appetites and how his lack of discipline would come to subsume his presidency. I mean, it's completely prescient in how it predicts that. And the way Phil Hartman does it is just perfect, you know, through the eating of the cheeseburgers, and as it goes through, you know, they keep making fun of Bill Clinton, and you know, they have him do some Weekend Update bits where they basically have him talking about, you know, the affairs that he's having while he's in office. And nobody knew anything about, like, the Monica Lewinsky stuff yet, but SNL was on it. They suspected it and they predicted it. And then, of course, once the Monica Lewinsky thing broke, they were all over that and it had something. Some of it was fairly tasteless, like when they had John Goodman playing Linda Tripp. Some of that stuff, but they really went after Clinton. And for a lot of, you know, political conservatives that think, well, you know, the show is just, you know, kind of a lefty show. There are a lot of moments, and I've written about this, there are a lot of moments that I think conservatives would watch the show and be actually kind of impressed by. They do take some nuanced positions on some of the things, you know, whether it's taking on the modern, political correctness that's going on out there. They do that. So there are some moments, but the Clinton one was definitely one of the big ones. And then, of course, you know, you can't mention politics on SNL without talking about Tina Fey coming back to play Sarah Palin.
Oh, my gosh. And we have a clip of this, which is, well, let's listen to Tina Fey.
Every morning when Alaskans wake up, one of the first things they do is look outside to see if there are any Russians hanging around. If there are, you got to go up to them and ask, what are you doing here? And if they can give you a good reason, they can, then you start responsibility to say, you know, shoo, get back over there.
Right on.
Right. So it was that happened right after. People forget John McCain named Sarah Palin as his vice presidential candidate. And right after that, he got a big boost out of that. He surged ahead of Obama in the polls. But then the facade started to come down a little bit. And part of that was because SNL went after Sarah Palin through Tina Fey so viciously. And some of it, they just didn't even have to write a sketch. They could just kind of say things that Sarah Palin had already said, had actually said during the week, and it was funny enough. At some point they took a poll and asked who said, I can see Russia from my house. And people actually thought Sarah Palin had said that, when in fact it was actually Tina Fey in an SNL sketch that had said that. But the two just kind of melded together. And then you know, McCain and Palin, helped by the 2008 financial collapse, really sank after that.
You know, these debate sketches, and we mentioned them, they've been a staple of the show for since the days of Ford and Carter, I think. And one of the – do you have a favorite?
Oh, there are so many good ones. Some of the best were the There's the Michael Dukakis one where he's running against George H.W. Bush, played, of course, brilliantly by Dana Carvey, where Dukakis says, I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
Oh, we've got that clip.
Like, oh, yeah?
It was, we've got Hawks as Diane Sawyer.
Jan Hooks, yeah.
And Dana Carvey as George Bush and John Lovitz as Michael Dukakis.
You still have 50 seconds left, Mr. Vice President.
Well, let me just sum up. On track, stay the course, 1,000 points of light, stay the course.
Mm-hmm. Governor Dukakis, rebuttal.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
So this is one of the points regarding politics on the show. It has not only the ability to comment on current politics that is happening at the time, because it literally happened a couple days before, and then here it is in a sketch on TV. So the show has a unique ability to comment on the politics that's happening. But then it also has the ability to push politics in a way that no other show does, because they start to coin phrases. Like, you remember when Al Gore, Daryl Hammond is playing Al Gore, and he coins the term lockbox. And there's another sketch where he's just all Al Gore during the debate wants to talk about is his lockbox. And so they started making fun of him, like, during the real campaign about this. There's a sketch where Will Ferrell is playing George W. Bush during one of the debates, and he comes up with the term strategery. like if you had one word that could describe your policies, what would it be? And he winks and he smirks. And he says strategery, and that actually became a word that George W. Bush's actual staffers, their PR arm, started putting out memos saying from the Department of Strategery. So they were in on the joke, and it actually started kind of pushing America towards different talking points.
Christian Schneider, our guest today, he is talking with us about his podcast that really goes through all of the episodes of Saturday Night Live. It's so much fun talking with him and hearing some of these clips as well as we move along. And you can join in, too, question or comment or maybe an experience relating to it, Saturday Night Live, that you want to comment on. I hope you do. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll visit with the co-writer and director of the movie A Wisconsin Christmas Pie. It's a new movie filmed in Door County. And at 12:30, we'll look at the movies coming up in the fall. So we have a movie critic coming for you at 12:30 today. Right now, talking with Christian Schneider, his podcast is titled Wasn't That Special? 50 Years of Saturday Night Live. And still plenty of time for your comments. Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Mike in Sparta, we'll go to you now. Thanks for calling, Mike.
Hey, Professor, thanks so much. I respect and appreciate you so much. I was just wondering, I know Gilda Radner is gone, Hartman, Belushi, and Farley. Those are the only four I can think of. I wonder if Christian knows any others in the 50 years that have passed.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned the four that come immediately to mind.
Yeah, let's see. Denitra Vance, who was notable because she was one of the first African-American women on the show. Sadly, she died of breast cancer. I'm trying to think of any others.
Nothing else. Boy, nobody else comes to mind.
I'm at the age where as soon as I learn something new, something else gets pushed out. So I don't remember any off the top of my head, but that should be something you should be easily Googleable.
Charles Rocket?
Charles Rocket, yes. He's sadly, he passed. He was on that season six episode, or season six. He was the host of Weekend Update. Sadly, we actually had him as the worst cast member of all time. So R.I.P. Charles Rocket, but he was not a very good cast member.
Norm MacDonald.
Yes, Norm MacDonald. See, now they're all coming back.
So those there's a few more for you, Mike. Thanks for calling. Dave in Bluegrass, Iowa. Your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I was just up in Wisconsin last week listening to your show, but the one skit that really hit me was the Cheeseburger sketch with John Belushi, and it was allegedly a reflection of the Billy Goat Tavern in Chicago down on Rush Street. And two of my buddies and I went up there one time to try to find that place, and we couldn't find it. But we just got a big kick out of that skit.
Yeah.
As soon as we started doing the show, I went to Chicago to hunt down the Billy Goat Tavern. And you're right, it's difficult to find because it's kind of underground. It's under a street, but you can find it if you look hard enough. And they still do the cheeseburger thing.
cheeseburger. Oh, thanks, Dave. And
the burgers are delicious, by the way.
I was trying to remember the columnist in Chicago who used to go to the Billy Goat Tavern.
Was it like, Royko?
Mike Royko. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Jeff and Barry Mills, we'll go to you.
Yes, I was in North. I don't think anybody's brought up Jane Curtin's name yet, and I just wanted to throw that into the conversation.
Jane Curtin, of course, was outstanding. She was more of the ones that kind of didn't want to look silly. she was more kind of like a straight woman. She excelled in kind of being the host of a talk show, that type of thing, where she would be the host and, you know, the guests would be crazy or, you know, doing something. And so she was more the person that they would play off of. And she was great at her job. She was wonderful. And, you know, when Chevy Chase left the show, they handed a Weekend Update over to her. And she did a great job as a Weekend Update host. So that shows you the respect that they had for her at the time.
How important was that parody of Weekend Update to the success of the show, do you think?
It was very, very important. Some of the biggest stars the show has had are the Weekend Update hosts because they get to say their names at the beginning. And that a lot of people say that that's the reason Chevy Chase was kind of the first breakout star of the show, because he hosted Weekend Update where he got to say, "I'm Chevy Chase and you're not." So America got to know the name Chevy Chase before any of the other cast members. So, yeah. I mean,
who was the best?
This is a
tough
one. Of
the Weekend anchors.
I think I have to go with Dennis Miller, just because the show's in such dire straits after season 11. There's a whole documentary about how awkward and weird season 11 was, which was 1985, 86. And it looked like they were just going to drop Weekend Update altogether. But then they bring in Dennis Miller, and he kind of reformulates the whole thing and shows, oh, this actually can be really good again, because it hadn't been. There was a time on Weekend Update where they just ditched having a host and they would have the host of the show host Weekend Update. So Bob Uecker, when he hosted SNL, he hosted Weekend Update. They were just going to ditch having a host altogether. So I think Dennis Miller really kind of set the tone. He cast the die, and you know, political humor from then on really took off. Those were the years when, you know, right before The Daily Show and these other types of news/comedy shows started to come about. And I think that was in large part because Dennis Miller was so good.
In your opinion, from Mike, what's the worst Saturday Night Live episode?
We did do a list of the worst episodes. There's a really bad one hosted by Hilary Swank one year. There was one hosted by Kiki Palmer a couple of years ago that really wasn't great. I think the ones that are that are most irritating is when they do have like a great host and you know somebody who could be a great host, but it really falls flat. Those are the ones that are most disappointing, yeah. Really.
Tom and McGuanigo wonders if a lot of original members came from Second City.
That's true. There was kind of a competition between people who had been at Second City. You know, Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Horatio Sanz, Belushi. I mean, this whole cadre of people. Mike Myers was at Second City briefly. Tim Meadows. So you have the Second City people, and then they're competing with the people at the Groundlings, which is in Los Angeles, where you had Will Ferrell and Kristen Wiig and John Lovitz and Phil Hartman and Lorraine Newman was actually a founding member. So you have these two kind of comedy troupes that are in competition for SNL slots. And then you have the stand-ups also,
yeah.
who come to the show and succeed. Dana Carvey was really more of a stand-up when he came to the show. So those are really the pools that they have.
And Michael in Middleton emails back, Jan Hooks, rest in peace.
Absolutely, yeah. That was a sad one when she died of cancer. Also, star of Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
yeah.
One of my favorite movies. Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman, actually tried out for SNL and did not get the show because they hired Gilbert Gottfried in season 6. So there are a lot of interesting what ifs of like, had they hired this person, what would the show have looked like going forward? At some point, you know, they tried to pick out a lot of the SCTV people from Canada, and they tried really hard to get John Candy to be on SNL. So you can imagine, like, what a cast with, you know, Eugene Levy and John Candy and Catherine O'Hara and Eddie Murphy and Joe Piscopo and, like, Tim Kazurinsky, that whole crew would have been, like, in the early 80s. It would have been really something special.
Tell us a little bit more about the podcast. I mean, how's it formatted and laid out and so forth?
So basically, we would watch a full season of SNL, and then we would do a single episode summarizing that season. We would talk about kind of the big themes, our favorite things about it, and then in the second half of each podcast, we pick out the best sketches, the most valuable cast member, sketches that could never be done today, and a whole list of, we kind of give out awards for all of these things. So I think it gives a pretty good idea of every single season. And to my knowledge, it's the most complete you know, thing that's ever been done about SNL, because we do all 50 seasons. And hopefully, if you listen, there's a lot of sketches that you'll remember fondly. And hopefully we mention a lot of sketches that you had forgotten, or that everybody had forgotten, that are actually really good.
And wasn't that special, the title of your podcast, wasn't that special, 50 years of Saturday Night Live, wasn't that special, came from...
Right, that's a play on Dana Carvey's Church Lady, where she said, isn't that special? Like, that was her catch line, so yeah, we jumped on that.
I tell you, it's been a lot of fun talking with you today, Chris.
Yeah, it's been great being here.
It's been my pleasure to be able to talk with you today. And yeah, that's a lot of, you had to have done, I don't know how many hours you put in on this, but it had to have been.
Well, without commercials, it's about an hour per episode. So you can just add up. It's almost 1,000 hours in the last 2 years.
And several thousand more hours putting the podcast together and everything else.
That is true.
Great, great having you with us, Christian. Thank you so much.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks.
Christian Schneider, our guest today. His podcast, again, Wasn't That Special, 50 Years of Saturday Night Live. It's great to have him with us, and thank you so much for listening in. I hope you stay with us, because coming up, we're going to talk about a movie made in Door County, and I think you're going to enjoy hearing about it as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us here on WPR News.
Stoner.
Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, if you think Christmas comes earlier every year, you may be right. We're talking about a Wisconsin Christmas pie for the next half hour. It's a new holiday movie filmed entirely in Door County. The movie's about a pastry chef who comes home for the holidays and kind of, shall we say, reheats a romance with her high school sweetheart. And forget December. It comes out this week, as a matter of fact. John Stimson is our guest. He's the director, editor, and co-writer of A Wisconsin Christmas Pie. He's made over 20 movies in his career. And as we talk to John, I hope you'll join in. What Door County landmarks would you like to see featured in a movie? What do you love about Christmas films? Is it ever too early for them? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. John Stimson, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, great to be here. I'm very excited to talk about this movie. It was so much fun to make.
Oh, man, I got to tell you. And before we get into it, you've been doing this a long time. You got over 20 films. How'd you get started in the film business?
Oh, gosh. Everybody's got their own route into this. You know, I started when I got out of college. I wanted to be a movie star, just like a lot of young kids coming out of college. And I did my time out in Los Angeles, and I learned a lot. I was able to get my feet wet as an actor, but I very quickly learned that if you want to make stuff happen, you gotta create. So I started writing. I started to learn what it took to write a screenplay and sort of willed my career to life. And, you know, everything kind of, you know how life is. Everything moved me back towards New England, where I'm from. And, you know, I settled back here and raised my family. And you know, that's where I live and work. And I have for the last 30 plus years. But,
well,
you know.
You mentioned New England. And I think you've done 9 of Christmas movies in your career, and most of them happened in New England. What led you to Door County for A Wisconsin Christmas Pie?
Oh, boy. You know, it's funny. I did a movie that came out last year called A Very Vermont Christmas. And in that film, we shot that one here in New England, Massachusetts in particular. It's where I live. And there's a wonderful tax credit here in the state, and that allows us to help underwrite our projects. But anyway, I had used a song in the movie last year by a woman named Stacy Griesbach, who is a musician, and she started the Door County Jazz Festival last summer. And she called me up, it was a year and a half ago now, and she said, "Hey, what do you think about shooting a movie in Door County, Wisconsin?" I said, "I don't know anything about Door County, Wisconsin, but tell me." She said, "It's the Cape Cod of the Midwest." I said, "Well, I did do another movie called A Cape Cod Christmas, and I spent a lot of time on Cape Cod." I said, "Well, I'm all ears." And long story short, she and I went out and we visited out there, and we met a lot of folks out there, and the people that she'd been working with on her jazz festival, and the Destination Door County people, and some of the travel groups that are in Wisconsin that are, you know, trying to get tourism, more tourism to the area. And one thing led to another, and everybody seemed excited about us making a movie. So I said, I better write the script.
That is great.
Well, it took, you know, I did a lot of research and met a lot of folks and traveled around out there, saw all the beautiful locations, spent some quality time in Door County so that we could make this movie be as authentic as possible.
Well, here's something I'm sure you don't know. Stacy Griesbach was a student of mine way back in the day and took a broadcast class from me. And I've had her come back to the class to give a talk along the way. She's a wonderful gal.
Oh, lots, so much energy, so much fun. Yes, absolutely. Oh, that's so great. What a coincidence. Yeah. Oh, she's probably the biggest supporter, biggest rooting, you know, fan of Door County you can imagine. She's great. She's great. She sold me.
Well, and you know, Door County isn't just where the movie was shot. I view it as a kind of an important character in the movie.
Yes, I think you're right. And thank you for picking that up. Not only is it a pristine and gorgeous and beautiful place, but it suits itself so well to one of these Christmas movies. It has that small town feel. It's the idea of a resort area in the off season where things are quiet. The feeling of the rural feeling, the emphasis on agriculture, the orchards, the farming, the cherry pie, so all of that sort of fell into line very, very easily, and suited itself very nicely for a Christmas film. So that was pretty neat. But the other piece of it, though, that I hooked into that we certainly use in the movie is the idea of multi-generational family business.
Yeah.
The idea of a legacy of a character or a person having this desire or this need to continue their family's legacy, their business over multi-generational organizations. And so that really appealed to me and felt really real. And in talking to places like where we shot, you know, the orchards that we used were Lautenbach's orchards. That family was a great example of that. Henriksen's Fisheries, same kind of thing. You know, these businesses have been passed down to their kids over generations and have thrived over the years. And that ended up playing a crucial role in our story.
It really did. And I have to say, I really enjoyed the film. I really enjoyed the film.
Thank you.
Well, you had some great cast members, and we'll talk about them in a minute, but I want to get Jason and Bloomer on first, too, because Jason has, I think, a good question. Let's go there. Hi, Jason.
Yeah. Hi. So just kind of a general question. I have adult family homes, so individuals who are developmentally or physically disabled. And I have a couple who have been very interested in getting into movies or just getting into that spotlight a little bit, but they're so hesitant because you don't see it that much in cinema. I'm just kind of curious, like, what, on your guys' side, what is your casting like? How do they get involved in it? Trying to get some answers for them.
Yeah. How does casting work?
Well, casting is a tricky process, and getting folks like you that you work with involved is something that certainly seems to be happening more and more. There's been some wonderful projects. A good friend of mine did a Christmas film. That involved a young woman with Down syndrome, and she was terrific in the film. And so there, I think the opportunities are more and more are coming up more and more. But casting is tricky, boy. And there's so few jobs and so much demand for the handful of jobs that come up. With our films, we try to hook our cast, the cast around, a couple of names of actors that have had some experience and have some name value that we can help promote the movie with. For instance, this movie stars Katie LeClaire, who was on a show called Switched at Birth, where actually, she's fluent in sign language, and she played a deaf girl in that show. The other fellow was a guy named Ryan Carnes, who was on Desperate Housewives and General Hospital. So we try to hook our cast around a couple of actors like that. But then we reached out as thoroughly as we could to the Chicago, the Milwaukee, the Green Bay communities that were nearby to where we wanted to shoot, because we wanted to use as much local talent as we could. you know, it's tricky when you're looking to get in touch with actors. What we use, I use casting directors, we use agents, we reach out to the communities to find our talent and through the channels that exist. And I work with Screen Actors Guild talent as well, so that can be a stumbling block for anybody trying to get in the business, of course, but it's not something that people should be overly concerned about, because everybody has to start somewhere. But yeah, it's a challenge, boy. I'll tell you, it's of all the things I as I was saying to Larry, I started off wanting to be an actor and I did a lot of work. And I very quickly learned, though, that if I was going to make a career in this business, I needed to be able to call my own shots. And that's when I turned to writing and directing and creating from the end I'm on now.
And as I think about the film, you did use some real Door County business owners in the film. I can remember a couple: Kristen Sequist, who owns Sequist Orchards, excuse me, in Sister Bay, and Rob Scaturro of Scaturro's.
Yeah, baking yep, they company. Both have they have pies in the contest. So we have a cherry pie contest. And so, yes, we use the actual bakeries and orchards from the area. You're absolutely right. And then we use the Hendrickson's Fisheries guys, we use their boat, and they helped us a lot, so we could have an authentic feel to our character that Ryan Carnes plays, a fisherman. And we really wanted that to have an authentic feel. And then we also shot at the White Gull Inn in Fish Creek. We went and we shot at we recreated the Chris Kindle Market up in Sister Bay. And that was exciting.
Beautiful.
Oh, fantastic. Oh my gosh. It was so great. And you know, the thing about it too, is we got so lucky. We shot in March, sort of late March, and you never quite know what you're going to get in terms of weather, but we got real snow. We got a big storm on the very first day we were shooting. And that was fantastic. Because we're always struggling with the snow, because the networks always want the Christmassy feel to the movies. And it seems like we tend to shoot these things at the time of year we're racing before the buds bloom on the trees. But we did get some authentic real snow, and it was terrific.
I was going to ask you about that, because I thought, I wonder if he had to sort of bring the snow in a fake way.
yeah. Well, we always do budget a fair amount of visual effects and special effects where we augment and we place snow, or we make the scenes look frostier than they might have been otherwise. But in this case, we were able to rely on the real thing much more so than we usually do, which was such a treat. It was such a treat. That was great.
I think there's a perception that TV-type holiday movies like A Wisconsin Christmas Pie are just made really quickly. Give us a sense of the production schedule on that.
Yeah. Well, these are in the scheme of things, they are smaller films. We shot this one in 3 weeks. Well, at the end of March, and it rolled over into the early April, but the process obviously takes a lot longer than just production. So Stacy and I started scouting about this time of year, last year. I think was about the time we made our first trip out there, and then began the scripting process and the pre-production process through the fall, over Christmas, and then come the early into January, when it looked like things might actually happen, then we got into the full-on pre-production mode and started to hire people and make our budget, start to get serious about locations and where is this all going to happen, and talking to people and pulling all the pieces together so that we could make it happen in March.
You know, my former wife was a pastry chef, and I used to watch her work. And she, Renee, there was a professionalism about it. There was an ease with using the materials that she was using for a pie or pastries of any kind. And I saw that same feeling when I had that same feeling when I watched Katie LeClaire working with the pies and the pastries. I mean, she looked like she was a professional pastry chef. And I was really impressed with that. I mean,
I'm so glad you picked up on that, Larry, because she is a baker. She's not professionally, but she has her little side job called Katie Bakes. And she, when we were pitching this movie to the networks to try to, she made pies, and we went and we had meetings with network executives when she brought a fresh cherry pie that she made to give to the various executives that we were talking to, because she's a wonderful chef and a wonderful baker. And so when she got this script and we started talking to her about it, she said, oh, this is a dream job for me, because she absolutely loves to bake. And so you're right on. I mean, she had such a comfort level. As a matter of fact, we sort of relied on her as our expert. You know, it's like, okay, well, what are the steps here? What do we do? How do we make sure, you know, the idea that the water has to be ice cold when you mix it in with the flour, and, you know, just the little touches that she was able to bring. And like you said, the ease at which, you know, she was able to go about it, it was wonderful. And so we had a lot of fun with those baking scenes. We really did.
She is really good, and you've used her in, I think, another. I'm sure you've used her in other films.
Four other films.
Four other films.
This is our fifth film together. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well,
She's a dear friend. She's wonderful. She's not only a wonderful actress, but she's become a dear, dear friend, and you know, we stay in touch and spend time together, and you know, she knows my whole family, and it's terrific. No, she's just great, and you know, that's the kind of actor you just, if you have the chance to do it again, you say yes in a minute, in a heartbeat.
Well, and I just thinking of the other actors, I thought Seamus Flynn,
The little boy,
the Max, the young boy, was very good. Where did you find him?
He's a Chicago kid.
Oh, Chicago kid.
Yeah. And he was a fine boy. He has such a natural ability. You know, I've worked with a lot of kids over the years, and you know, you come across most of the kids you work with are, you know, they have kind of a stagey, kind of Disney kind of big, flashy, they flash their smile, they try to be cute and stuff. But Seamus just had a natural, lovely connection when I auditioned him, where he was just so real. He just felt like a real little boy. And I said, oh my God. And not only is he adorable and melts your heart when you watch him, but he just has such a natural ability to deliver a line and be very present and very natural in a scene. And boy, I tell you, he was terrific. I hope he continues in the business, because he's really, really good.
And you used some veterans. I mean, Ed Amatrudo and Deborah Ferrantino. I mean, they played Emma's parents. And they've got long careers. And, I mean, they're really professionals who carry their roles so well.
Yeah, I'm glad you thought so, because I really, really enjoyed not only working with them, but their performances were just lovely. And, you know, Ed, just in the movie, he breaks your heart when he sort of, you know, comes clean about the struggles that he's having with the business to his daughter. And, you know, he's so raw and emotional. It's lovely. It's really the performance that he gave. And Deborah as well. I mean, as their parents, it was a treat. It was a real treat to work with them.
And you had a surprise kind of guest.
I'm glad you picked up on it.
Near the end of the show, who is well-known in Wisconsin.
Yes, indeed. Amon Green has a wonderful cameo in the film. That was so fun. We thought about that and we said, gosh, wouldn't it be a kick to see if we could get somebody connected with the Green Bay Packers to be part of this film? And when Amon said yes, they said, oh, fantastic.
A member of the Green Bay Packers Hall of Fame. It was
absolutely.
It was a surprise and a treat to see him as a judge. And he did. He did pretty darn well too.
He did a great job, didn't he? I thought he was fantastic. He was so leading the cheer. Go Pack, go!
Oh gosh, I got a kick out of Kissing Balls.
Right? Had you even heard of them before?
I never heard of Kissing Balls before. Where did that come up from?
I don't know if it's a Door County thing, but it's the first place I ever saw them. And, and literally that was one of the things when we scouted out, we visited, said, this is the thing. Because there's so many of these wonderful Christmas shops up in Door County. Yeah. The Tannenbaum shop, which is the one we used, which is fantastic. And there's another place called St. Nick's. And actually the owners of St. Nick's, they made the Kissing Balls for us. But that's where I learned about them. I said, well, this is way better than just mistletoe.
And I would assume that a lot of this had to be with the businesses. For example, there's this just gorgeous film part of the film that takes place as the two main characters are walking through a Christmas ornament.
That's the Tannenbaum shop. Yes, isn't that incredible? That's the real place. That's how it walked in, and it's kind of a Christmas overload. I think we could never decorate a place that looked this gorgeous. Yeah, wasn't that spectacular?
And so you didn't really have to do any or very much with it.
Not there. We, all we did was sort of figure out where we're going to stage the scene and put the kissing balls. And that was all set for us. They were terrific. They were so helpful. That's right up in Sister Bay as well.
And it's, I want to make sure before we run out of time that where people are going to be able to see this movie.
Yes, indeed. Well, it starts streaming on Thursday this week on the Great American Family Pure Flix streaming channel, but it premieres on the Great American Family Network Saturday at 8 o'clock, 8 p.m. Maybe it might be 7 central. We have to check the Great American Family, and they have their whole Great American Christmas rollout is beginning this week, and it is so fantastic. And they're using our premiere as sort of the kickoff to the whole Great American Christmas rollout, which we couldn't be more flattered and excited about. So it's great.
Well, it is. It's a great film. I really enjoyed it, and I hope a lot of people get to see it.
Me too. I know that the whole Door County community is very excited about it, and we're thrilled to be able to give this gift, this Christmas gift, back to Door County because they were so wonderful to us.
Would you ever do another one in Wisconsin, another film?
Well, I'd love to. And as a matter of fact, I think because of the efforts that we did and the crews that we hired from Wisconsin, I believe the legislature has passed a film tax credit that's getting going and to try to bolster the film community up there and get more projects coming into Wisconsin. I would love to do another one. Midwest Nice is a real thing. And I was so, I was bowled over by it. And I was so happy to be there and to work with the folks locally. So,
John, a pleasure talking with you today. I hope we have another chance to talk about a film you make in Wisconsin. Thank you so much.
Larry, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
John Stimson, a founder of H9 Films and the writer, director, producer, and editor of over 20 movies, his latest, A Wisconsin Christmas Pie. Great to have him with us. And coming up, we're going to take a look at the fall movies that we can look forward to. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. You know, traditional wisdom is that the summer movie season is for the big blockbuster type movie. The fall is when the serious movies come out, the ones that are going to make the Academy Awards. And we'll see if that holds true today as we talk with our guest back with us once again, Jameson Rabbit. And as you listen, thank you for joining in. Jameson has hosted a movie review program. It's called Real, R-E-E-L, Real Reviews, for the past decade. It's also on staff of the Wisconsin Film Festival. And as we move along today, I hope you'll join in. What are you excited about seeing this fall, perhaps? Are you hoping for something with a little less action and maybe a little more acting? Give a call, the number, or and also you might comment on the summer movie that you might have seen as well. And if you liked it and why. Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Jameson Rabbit, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, it's great to be back here, Larry. Good to see you.
Let's, you know, before we go to the fall season, maybe let's recap the summer a little bit.
Sure.
How good or bad was this summer's movie season?
I think it was kind of average. there were some really good ones. You know, I really enjoyed movies like Superman and Sinners was a movie that came out this summer that was a great success. F1,
yeah.
Was really exciting. Good, big summer movie. And then there were some, you know, the new Jurassic World Rebirth, which was just re-churning over familiar territory and made big money, so they'll keep making them. But,
it did make big money.
It did. Those dinosaur movies always make money. That's why they keep, I mean, they got Scarlett Johansson to come in to make this movie with them. I mean.
Yeah.
They make money whether they're good or not is debatable.
Is there a worst one that you could comment on from the summer?
I mean, there was Happy Gilmore 2 was pretty bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was not great.
Well, fall is the time when studios release movies they think have a good chance at the Oscars. Has that always been the case? Mostly.
It's been the case for quite a number of years. And basically, it comes down to the calendar. 40 years ago, the Academy Awards changed their calendar of when films are eligible. It used to go July to July, and then they said, let's just make it a calendar year. The end of the year is the end of the year for award nomination considerations. So then naturally, studios start packing their quote-unquote prestige films as late in the year as possible because they want it to be fresh in your memory.
Rare
is the time when a movie that comes out in April wins the Academy Award. I mean, we had it a couple years ago. Everything Everywhere All at Once was a spring movie that won Best Picture, but usually those movies are forgotten by the time award season rolls.
I was trying to remember when Titanic came out.
That would have also been a late summer movie,
Yeah, I was thinking that might have been a late summer movie.
Yeah.
There are themes, were there themes that you notice with this year's crop of fall movies?
One thing I noticed is just a lot of really great directors making films this year. Sometimes we go through lags where it feels like everyone's working on a movie at the same time. This year we have a lot of prestigious filmmakers coming out with movies. And that's always exciting. That's kind of the first thing I look for at the beginning of the year is, what directors do I love that have a great track record are coming out with something this year? That's what I'm looking forward to.
What are some of the films that have already come out this fall that you liked or maybe didn't like?
So one that I just watched a couple of times that came out a couple weeks ago is the new Paul Thomas Anderson film, One Battle After Another, which is, at this moment, my favorite movie of the year. It's incredible. I mean, it's almost a three-hour film. I went and saw it twice last week. It's pretty great, and I'm expecting that to be talked about when we roll into award season.
What's it about?
Oh, man, it is a dense story about revolutionaries trying to overthrow the government, and then a relationship that goes awry and revenge tales, and it's It's intense.
There's a lot going on.
It is frenetic. Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, Julia Roberts is back with a new movie coming out next weekend. I think it's called After the Hunt.
Right. Yes. She has a new one from director Luca Guadagnino. It's she and Andrew Garfield and Ayo Adebi. It's it's this kind of psychological drama, and that's kind of the hallmark of this time of year. You get your dramas, your big actors. It is still October, so we have a little bit of the psychological thriller involved in it, about a professor who finds her life upended when a student makes an accusation. And if you know anything about director Luca Guadagnino, nothing is simple and linear in the storytelling of this movie.
Looking, and Julia Roberts, you think she'd be a good person for that role?
Yeah, she's always great. She's Julia Roberts, like the definition of movie star.
And Catherine Bigelow, I think, was the first woman to direct a Best Picture winner.
For The Hurt Locker, yes.
Yeah, she has a political thriller.
Yes, I'm very excited for this one.
I think it's called House of Dynamite?
House of Dynamite, yes. Comes out October 24th. It'll be on Netflix. And stars Idris Elba. It's about an impending missile crisis that's about to hit America and how the White House handles it. And it's told in real time. So it happens over the course of basically 2 hours of how this would actually happen. And Catherine Bigelow is great at all films. I mean, but action especially, she is great at this. So I'm very excited for this. And it's on Netflix.
And it's coming out when?
October 24th.
Well,
it's almost here.
I'm on Netflix, so
there you go.
I'll be looking for that one.
Yeah.
Do you think political films can work right now with the people? I'm wondering if people are kind of burned out on regular politics.
You might be onto something there because regular life is so political right now. It's tough. The way things are going right now, it's interesting to see how it'll work. If people are looking for an escape and don't want to be having to face things that they're already facing in their regular life, or if this divides a crowd. But One Battle After Another is a political-ish film, and that was pretty well received so far. So
yeah,
we'll see.
And speaking of politics, James Brooks, who was the guy that created the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which is, 50 years ago,
yeah,
has a new movie coming out with a political bent.
Yeah, it's a film called Ella McKay, stars Emma Mackey. It feels like it's kind of a dramatic comedy almost.
I gotta believe the guy who produced the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Yeah, I mean, he's great at kind of comedies and fills this with a comedic cast. I mean, he's got Albert Brooks in here, Woody Harrelson, Jamie Lee Curtis, about a young woman who's dealing with being an adult and dealing with family that can disappoint you and all kinds of craziness that happens to this young woman in this film. And it's just it's a great comedic cast.
And what's the title again?
This is Ella McKay.
Ella McKay.
Yes.
All right. I'm moving along with the ones that I know of and remember. Rose Byrne is kicking up some Oscar buzz with her role in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You.
Yes, and this also comes out this Friday, October 10th. So you don't have to wait long for this one. And Rose Byrne is a great actress, and she's really the center of this film. She's a woman kind of finding herself overwhelmed by life. Life is just kind of crushing her in every direction. And eventually, that kind of pressure will lead to a break of some sort, whether it's a good break or a break in her mentality. And one of the people who serves as kind of an antagonist to her is her therapist, who is played by Conan O'Brien in a serious role.
And is this his first role?
I believe it is, yes. I believe. And he plays a kind of narcissistic therapist, not comedic from what I can tell in any way. Kind of a real stretch for first-time actor Conan O'Brien.
And even though we think sequels and remakes are for the summer, there's one coming out in the fall, Kiss of the Spider Woman. That's an adaptation of a Broadway show, isn't it?
I believe so, yeah. I've never seen the original, but yes, this is a title that I've heard in the past.
I'm wondering, how frequent or common, I guess I should say, are these movie musical movie adaptations?
I mean, more and more. We're going to have a couple of them this fall. You know, we have this one. We have another one coming out later in the fall. Musicals have their place in cinema right now. There was a while where they were kind of a dead genre, and now they're kind of rolling along again.
Talking today with Jameson Rabbit about the fall movies and what's coming out for you and I to see, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions. Maybe you have a comment about a past film, maybe a question about what's coming up in the fall. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, we uncover the mystery of a shipwreck discovered off the shores of Door County. And then we'll talk to the executive director of the Portage County Historical Society and then chat with best-selling author and humorist David Sedaris. He's out now on tour. And right now, though, we're taking a look at the fall movies with our guest, James Rabbit. He's the host of Real Reviews for the Sun Prairie Media Center. Been going on since 2014, something like that.
That sounds about right, yeah.
Yeah. So join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234 or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. Jean in Minnesota emailed. She said she watched a movie called Steve with Cillian Murphy. It's on Netflix.
It just came out on Netflix last week, yeah.
Yeah, she wondered what your reaction to it was.
I haven't had the opportunity yet to watch it. It just came out this past Friday, I believe.
Oh, so really fresh.
Yeah, yeah, but Cillian Murphy's great. I mean, he just won the Academy Award for Oppenheimer.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's keep going on with these sequels and remakes then. Mm-hmm. You care about a new Tron movie or maybe a new Predator movie?
Yeah, I'm kind of ambivalent about both of them. New Tron movie, Jeff Bridges is back. I mean, he was in the original eons ago. I'm sure the effects are going to look great. That's kind of what Tron movies base themselves on. I don't know. It feels out of place to me here. The same with the Predator movie. The Predator franchise has been incredibly hit or miss for me.
Yeah, there have been some real stinkers. But the first one was...
It's legendary. Now, the only thing
really
is this...
Really good.
This new one, Predator Badlands, is from director Dan Trachtenberg. He made a Predator side movie during the pandemic called Prey, which was great. It had a female antagonist fighting a Predator. This is not connected to that, despite the fact that he directed both. So I have kind of middling hopes for it.
Yeah, and thinking about Predator, we've got a remake of an old Schwarzenegger movie, The Running Man.
Yes. I'm very excited for this movie, actually.
Are you?
So The Running Man, I rewatched the original recently. It's a fun story. It's aged. It feels its age, but the concept is great.
Yeah,
and especially
I love
today,
the concept of
if you
it.
Tell me that they're going to actually have a Running Man game show where they're putting people into this, I wouldn't be that surprised. Director Edgar Wright is great coming up with this. And Glenn Powell, I think he's going to be wonderful in this movie. I'm actually kind of excited for this.
Yeah, I was kind of looking forward to that one as well. And one of the most, I think about the, talk about high-profile movies, the second half of Wicked.
Yeah, Wicked for Good.
What'd you think of the first one?
I really enjoyed it. Yeah, I mean, my daughter was very excited to go see that. We've watched it many times since it's come out on streaming. Now, from what I know, though, that part two of the Wicked musical is kind of the weaker half of the two, the post-intermission. So I don't know. We'll see. But this has a lot of excitement. It's coming out the weekend before Thanksgiving, which is a great time to put out movies. And yeah, it's
especially one like that.
It's going to be gangbusters. It's a family movie that everyone can go see and enjoy.
Yeah. I saw the first with my daughter.
Sure.
And we liked it,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
You know, the one movie that when it, the first version of it that came out, I really liked a lot was Avatar.
Sure. That was 2009. Can you believe that?
And then the second movie was like, all right, this is Avatar, the same thing.
Yeah.
What's the, do you know the storyline this time?
Fire and Ash. It's the third film of this franchise, and it's the same characters, only new tribes now are introduced. A fire tribe is introduced, where we had the water tribe in the second film. It looks like it's going to be the same movie again, Larry. And it's 3 hours and 12 minutes long.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. It's a bladder tester. I have fatigue with this franchise already.
But I like the first one.
Sure. The first one was groundbreaking. But I feel like they're just recycling old territory over and over again. And I'm struggling to stay interested.
And, of course, Halloween usually brings some scarier horror movies. Most notably, I think we've got a new adaptation of Frankenstein.
Yes, we do. And that's also going to be streaming. That is from director Guillermo del Toro, one of my favorite directors. And that is going to be hitting November 7th onto Netflix. Another one you can just sit at your couch and watch. Classic monster movie. This one stars Jacob Elordi as Frankenstein's monster. And, I'm excited for this one.
Do we look every year? There's a scary movie at Halloween, isn't there?
You have to. Yeah, it's mandatory. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're not. But, yeah, we have to get them.
Any good comedy movies for this fall?
Yes. It's kind of a light season for comedies. I mean, it's not the top time of the year for it. There's a film from Aziz Ansari called Good Fortune that he wrote, directed, and starred in with him and Keanu Reeves and Seth Rogen that looks kind of funny, kind of a life-switching. Keanu Reeves is an angel and switches their lives around between a successful guy and a poor guy. Roofman is a new movie that stars Channing Tatum, I guess based on a true story of a guy who breaks into a store. I don't know. It looks like a weird comedy. There's a film called Anaconda starring Jack Black and Paul Rudd that looks like a wild madcap comedy. Don't know if it's going to be any good. But, it's this time of year is more for the serious fare, the prestige films, as opposed to your madcap comedies.
Well, an Iranian movie called It Was Just an Accident.
Yes.
Won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival. What's unique about this movie?
It's France's submission. It's a dual submission between France and Iran. It's France's official submission for the upcoming Oscars, the 2026 Oscars. It is a thriller exploring political repression in Iran. The filmmaker, Jafar Panahi, has been arrested multiple times for creating, films condemning policies in Iran, and they don't really like that much. This film is probably going to land him in hot water as well. It looks incredibly interesting. And, it's all in Iranian and French.
I am a big fan of Bruce Springsteen.
Okay.
And there's a movie, Deliver Me From Nowhere.
Right.
But it only covers the making of one of his albums.
Right, just the Nebraska album.
So I'm sure there must be some non-Springsteen fans. I'm wondering... I think of Springsteen fans are going to go.
Yeah. I mean, it's Jeremy Allen White from The Bear stars as younger Bruce, 1982 era Bruce Springsteen. Mm-hmm. I've been seeing a lot of publicity about this. Those two out hitting the red carpet together going, don't we look alike? Look at us. I mean, personally, I kind of have been hitting music biopic fatigue. It feels like every year there's one or two of them. I'm hopeful this is good. It is interesting that it is so tightly focused on one period of his life as opposed to a spanning film. But I'm expecting it to do well at the box office.
And speaking of biopics, there's a movie, Song Sung Blue.
There you go.
What's that about? And explain its ties to Wisconsin.
Yeah, it comes out on Christmas Day. It stars Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson as a duo. This is based on true people that call themselves Lightning and Thunder, and they were a a Neil Diamond and Patsy Cline tribute act from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who you may have seen on the state fair circuit back in the 90s. It's an interesting story. They survived trauma. They found surprising success because they were just a small tribute band. And it's a really interesting story. I watched the trailer the other day, and it looks incredibly sweet.
Oh, well, good. Yeah. I like sweet films, too.
Yeah, exactly.
The Wisconsin movie we were just talking about earlier, kind of a sweet movie, and really enjoyed it a lot. Anything to take the kids to this season besides what we've talked about?
The one movie that I think stands out, and I ask my daughter what she's excited for, Zootopia 2 is the big animated movie, one of her favorite anime movies, frankly, one of my favorite animated movies of the last 5-6 years. Disney animated movie that's coming out around Thanksgiving time. Should be really fun, looks really cute. It comes out November 26th. And that's kind of the one. There's not a lot of animated films coming out the rest of this year, though.
Okay. We've covered many movies. Yeah. Are there some others that were on your list for fall?
Yeah, absolutely. There's one called Begonia that comes out November 31st. It's a new film from Yorgos Lanthimos, who always makes fever dream type movies, and most of them star Emma Stone. This one has her and Jesse Plemons and Alicia Silverstone in it, and the trailer looks maddening. I'm very excited for that one. There's also a film coming out in December called Hamnet, which is centered around Shakespeare's wife as she struggles with the loss of her son, Hamnet. Stars Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. And then one of my favorite actors right now, Timothy Chalamet, has a film called Marty Supreme that's coming out on Christmas Day from Josh Safdie, whose brother just directed the new Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie, The Smashing Machine, that just came out. Now, the other brother, Josh Safdie, directs Timothy Chalamet in a story of a young man who goes to hell and back to chase a dream. It also stars Gwyneth Paltrow and a huge cast of people that you know filling this out for Christmas Day. This will be a big movie on Christmas weekend.
We're going to be watching a lot of these movies on Netflix from the sound of it. But how do you encourage folks to go to the theater?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of going to the theater, seeing it on the biggest screen possible. I know I said that when I was in here in June, when you're going to see big summer blockbusters, see them on the big screen. But even these movies that are more the drama type movies, they're enjoyable. We are blessed with so many great places to see a movie in this city. There's no excuse not to.
Yeah. Remind us, how do we watch your Real Reviews?
Real Reviews, sure. Yeah, you can find it locally through the Sun Prairie Media Center app. It's streaming. I also put it up on YouTube. If you search Real Reviews TV, Real Reviews TV, you can find it there, and we post our reviews of every movie we saw each month on there.
And are you Oscar nominations don't come out until January?
No, but I'm ready.
Any early predictions?
I have 5 movies on my list that I very much expect to be getting nominations for Best Picture. The first one is Hamnet, the one I just told you about. One Battle After Another, which I've talked about. Begonia. Sinners, which came out earlier this year, which is a great vampire movie you wouldn't expect, but it's great. I think it's going to get nominated. And then there's one called Sentimental Value from director Joachim Trier. He teams back with his collaborator, actress Renate Reinsve. They did Worst Person in the World a few years ago, which was one of my favorite movies. And it looks like it's just perfect Oscar bait.
What's it about?
I don't know. They haven't really put out a whole lot about it. And that kind of lends the intrigue, but it very much the two of them combined always seem to create Oscar buzz movies, and it'll probably be a movie that plays in one theater here on December 31st just to be nominated for the 2026 Oscars.
Jameson, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. Jameson Rabbit, our guest today, the host of Real Reviews for the Sun Prairie Media Center. He's been doing that since 2014. Big thanks to him. And a big thanks to you for listening, and also to our team of people here on the Larry Miller Show. Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod, Jeff Robbins, he produced this show today. Lee Rayburn, our outstanding technical director and on-air host as well. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Miller. Stay with us. There's lots more in store here on WPR News.